to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live this week from the SDPB Black Hills Bureau in beautiful downtown Rapid City. We're in the Parts Central building on Main Street. Stop by and say hello. We begin our hour with Mike Diedrich. He's Vice President of Governmental Affairs from Regional Health. He's here with me in the studio now. Welcome.
Good morning, Laurie. It's a privilege to be here in your new studios. It's a beautiful place in downtown.
Thank you. It's coming along. It's not officially open. You're here for the behind-the-scenes opening broadcast, so thanks for joining us. Been driving around the Black Hills this weekend and last night, looking and seeing a lot of your facilities there. So tell us a little bit about Regional Health and what all it encompasses in the Black Hills and beyond.
Regional Health is a system of healthcare providers. And we have 5 acute care hospitals. We have over 25 clinics in our system. We have 2 managed hospitals that Regional Health manages for other organizations. We have an assisted living, 2 nursing homes, 3 urgent care facilities. Plus, we also have multiple specialty treatment clinics as well.
So what geographic region do you cover then?
We cover western South Dakota, eastern, some eastern Wyoming, a little bit of north. Western Nebraska, and a little bit of southeastern Montana.
Sure.
So we serve approximately 250 to 300,000 patients in our area.
So some of the challenges from the geography and the population, the economy, what are some of the challenges of delivering healthcare in this region?
Well, the major challenges in our region is we're essentially a rural health system, and the delivery of healthcare in a rural setting is very challenging. They're known as underserved populations because the access to clinics, the access to healthcare is very limited. It's very expensive to provide, and it's difficult to recruit and retain caregivers and physicians to rural areas as well. And that's an experience that occurs all over the United States in rural areas.
One of the things that I've been hearing from folks I've been talking to is the cost of living is fairly high, wages are fairly low. Is that something that sort of crosses over into healthcare as well, or are you exempt from that sort of pattern of Black Hills region economy?
Well, the economy is what it is out here. It is a fairly high cost of living, and relatively speaking to other areas. As far as the workforce development and the competitive compensation to attract caregivers and physicians, Regional Health looks at the competing markets. And so that takes us into Colorado, takes us into Minnesota, takes us into other parts of South Dakota, Nebraska, the region within which we try to retain and attract and recruit physicians and caregivers.
How do you get the best ones to come here and stay? Have you met that particular challenge, or continuing to meet that particular challenge?
It's a very intense challenge all over the United States. The number of physicians has declined. The number of open physicians in most facilities has increased. The same with nursing and other licensed skilled professionals, as well as unlicensed support assistants. How do we get them? We want to make sure that they get to see the beautiful area that we live in South Dakota, in the community, the sense of community, the compassion. We provide a quality environment, a good work environment. We're committed to the highest values and quality and professionalism and patient care and patient experience. And we find that the really passionate, committed caregivers and physicians want to work in a place like that.
What's driving that shortage? Or are students not wanting to go into medicine like they used to? Is it too much of a sacrifice? Do you have a sense of where folks are not leading into the healing arts?
Part of the shortage is because of a change in the work ethics or the lifestyle. And so currently it'll take 2 new physicians to replace a retiring physician because the younger generations want to have a good work-life balance, and the model that you may recall from the past is a physician is making house calls or working on call 24/7, always there for the patient, and that model is fatiguing and it's passing, and so it takes more physicians to fill the current physicians.
Huh. And how does that impact patients then? If you had a physician that was working out of a different model where there was a little more balance Do patients sort of respond to that positively, or do they expect their doctor to be only their doctor 24/7, you're always here for me?
Well, they always need, and they rightfully expect to have access to health care 24/7. With the primary care providers, it's usually there's a couple of physicians who will share the information, or a group practice that shares all the information and has a relationship with the patient. But you typically have a relationship with your primary care provider. The medical recording systems that are available now makes the information, the patient's information, immediately available, and so there's no lag or issue related to a physician not being available because of whatever reason.
So let's talk about that sort of information and electronic medical records. Where are you at? Where is Regional Health at in that sort of push to the future?
Regional Health is implementing a new electronic health record system called EPIC. It is the national standard. It is utilized by most of the large systems throughout the country. It is a tremendous endeavor to implement a system like that. Healthcare systems typically have many legacy systems that are recording and communicating and billing and patient information that are bridged together through software development. EPIC is designed to consolidate all of that into one good system that talks to all the other systems as well and reduce our costs of maintaining those legacy systems and increasing the efficiency, the ability to slice and dice information to make it immediately available for a patient seeing a physician no matter where they are in the world.
Oh.
That's critical.
Where are you at as far as implementation? Is that ongoing?
It's been quite an effort, a long time with a lot of software developers and employees at Regional. It will be implemented in October, about October 22nd.
So do patients start seeing those changes when?
They'll start seeing them in October. So there's a big training effort going on now with all of the providers, with all of the employees that work on the Regional Health team, and also the independent physicians and group practices and entities that will also need to access the system.
And let's talk a little bit about public policy and the Affordable Care Act and its proposed replacements. The rest of the world has sort of stopped paying attention for a little bit, at least, not making some of the headlines that it was a few weeks ago. You probably haven't stopped paying attention at all. Where do you stand right now as far as health insurance, the Affordable Care Act, and what needs to happen next in your opinion?
Well, from as an advocate for good health care policy, for good federal health care and state health care policy, we're always looking out for our patients so that they have access, so that they have the skills and professional specialties that they need available to them, and that it's affordable. And so right now, the Senate did not approve the Better Care Reconciliation Act at the end of June. And when they return into session on September 4th in D.C., they'll be looking at perhaps some other changes, but we don't expect that they'll do a big omnibus change, which was what they attempted, and which is what the House passed in the AHCA on May 4th in this spring.
When you were following that, what were your thoughts about, was that good health care policy that they were looking at? Were there gaps in it that you were lobbying or following, with keen interest? What were the flaws in that program from your perspective?
Well, from our perspective, it was really, well, let's start with the beginning. Congress is intending to reduce the federal deficit by $337 billion in the next 10 years. And so how do they do that? They're looking at eliminating $808 billion out of federal spending on Medicaid. And so that means this whole plan has been to reduce Medicaid and the accessibility of Medicaid, shift the costs of Medicaid. So it's a large cost-shifting program by the federal government to shift the costs to the state and to the individuals. So through that process, the concern is that the affordability of insurance for so many lives that are now covered under the insurance exchange or through Medicaid, they would lose the ability to be covered, and they would then not seek health care until their problems became either chronic or acute rather than getting the preventative care. So the whole paradigm is shifting from a intense, expensive access to health care to a more preventative access to health care. And community health is incredibly important. Collaboration between hospital systems, providers, caregivers, school districts, municipalities, counties, and the state, and other health advocate organizations or providers is just really important to get preventative care to, and it, in the long run, it'll be the less cost, and that'll help reduce the costs that they spend on Medicaid.
Do you think the Affordable Care Act needs to be fixed, and what are the key components that you think need to be fixed and addressed first?
First, the Affordable Care Act needs to ensure that there is some mechanism of a subsidy or a tax credit to allow more people to access insurance on the exchange. Second, the states are in a better position to make decisions about how to use their Medicaid funds, and they can efficiently manage that to meet the needs of their populations rather than having a whole set of requirements that are determined on a federal level. The challenge with that is making sure that the resources for the states to make those decisions and utilize those funds is adequate. And so in the proposals on the federal level, they have reduced the amount of Medicaid funding from the federal government to the state. That will force the state to look at either reducing programs or reducing eligibility requirements, or increasing eligibility requirements to reduce the eligible population. And for states that did not expand Medicaid, it's going to be particularly difficult. And then especially in South Dakota, because we have a very efficiently run Department of Health and Department of Social Services and Medicaid program. And there isn't a lot of fat in their programs or in their budget or waste that can be trimmed out like there can be in many other states. And so the amount in the going forward federal funding that's been proposed so far has been either by a block grant or per capita, which basically caps the amount that's provided to the state. And if the state, and they'll set use that determination will be set on the past year, like 2016. For a state that didn't expand Medicaid, like South Dakota, we didn't have a large Medicaid budget. For a state that did, they would have a large budget. So right away, their base federal support is going to be higher than states who were more conservative and did not expand. So we'll have less to do more with, whereas the expansion states will have more to do.
Right. How will healthcare consumers or patients see that impact in the coming months as Congress decides to figure out what's next? What's going to happen before something gets adjusted, in your opinion?
Well, the insurance rates will increase. Continue to increase, and part of the reason for that is all the numbers of the anticipated eligibles for the ACA insurance exchange have not signed up, and they have not all got eligibility for Medicaid, and so there's a lot of uncompensated care out there, and the uncompensated care results in providers having to go to another source to make up those funds. They eat some of it and they go to another source. And so it
such as?
Well, if you look in our area, it's called a payer mix. What are your insurers? Who pays for your care? In our area, we're unique in that we have 70% of the payers of health care insurance are government programs. So it's Medicare, Medicaid, VA, TRICARE, IHS. Those are government payers. When they go to a hospital and say, this is what we're going to reimburse you for your services, there's really no negotiating, and they reimburse less than what it actually costs to provide the service. So the balance, the other 25-30% of the payers in our area are commercial or private insurers. And when we negotiate rates with them, we base it on the cost, and so the cost of the loss gets included in the cost of what the rates are negotiated with commercial carriers, which results in higher premiums to the consumers or the employers that provide that insurance.
Can you share with us, or do you have a sense of how much care is uncompensated that regional health just has to cover on their own? How much free care do you have to give out through your mission, but then also through the circumstances of health insurance in America today?
Regional Health provides $1 million a week of uncompensated care. And that's the charges for the care that we receive no reimbursement for, and it includes bad debt and charity as well.
Right. So who are those $1 million coming from? Is this the working poor? Is this people who have insurance and just can't handle the deductibles or the high cost of their MRI? Or what is it? Where is it coming from? Or is it people who just, you know, could have insurance and have decided not to do it and come in? $1 million a week. That's a big number.
That is a big number. It's all of the above, everything you said. So part of it comes from IHS, for example. We provide probably $500,000 to $750,000 a month of care to IHS eligible patients. Patients who come in and say, "I'm covered by IHS," and then we make a claim to IHS and they don't pay it. So we provide to IHS alone close to $700,000 a month of care they don't compensate for. Then you have people who buy insurance who maybe can afford it, but they get extremely high deductibles or co-pays because that helps make the premium affordable. And the result is that, and they're in a difficult financial situation, so they can't pay their co-pays or the deductibles. And so that ends up being a cost that's absorbed by a provider. People who just don't have insurance or can't afford insurance or don't know how to go about qualifying for insurance or help.
The Susan ER closure, how is that going to impact Regional Health?
Well, they closed on September 20th of 2016, and I checked on May 7th of 2017 to see what impact we had. We had at Regional Health 2,544 emergency department encounters by IHS eligible patients, meaning patients that come in and say IHS is responsible to pay for our care. And so we had 2,544 encounters with IHS eligible patients, of which the cost to provide that care, the charges for that was $6.5 million approximately. During that same period of time, out of the 2,544 encounters, IHS reimbursed Regional Health for 371. In an amount equal to $451,000. So that shows you the gap and some of the impact.
What needs to happen next? Final thoughts. What's the takeaway? What are the next steps here to sort of fix this for healthcare providers, for retention and staff, and then also obviously for patients?
Well, the end answer is to create an environment where reimbursement is above cost by federal payers, that the federal government, if it has an obligation to provide care to veterans or for American Indians, that they compensate for that care, to have affordable assurance available, because the more people that we can receive reimbursement for their care, when we provide care to everybody, but we don't get paid by everybody, the more people that we can provide care to that reimburses, provide us with more resources to do more good work of making access available in our rural areas, to be able to stay on the cutting edge of equipment and technology, to be able to recruit the best and the brightest to become centers of excellence in care, as we are in many areas, and to reinvest in the future.
Mike Diedrich is Vice President of Governmental Affairs from Regional Health. Thank you so much for being here today. Come back again.
I'd love to. Thank you.